Coaches, athletes, weekend warriors. Have you thought about recovery or regeneration? Today we oftentimes think in training about the stimulus we put on our body and the workload that we do to fatigue us daily. But we don't give enough to the recovery component. Simply Faster has numerous options to enhance your recovery in between the sessions of work that you put your body through daily. They have Theraguns, Normatic regeneration kits, and they're all cost-effective options. My athletes at my high school often use the Theragun in between intervals, race days, and training sessions. In the world we live in, it's hard to guarantee that we're going to get a doctor's visit. Simply Faster provides you the option where you don't have to be behind a paywall to get the care that you need with the equipment that they provide. So get yourself the regeneration and recovery that you need and level up. Simply Faster. Check it out.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jimson Lee for SpeedEndurance.com, and welcome to Speed Endurance TV. So on tonight's episode, we have Ryan Banta, best-selling author of the Sprinter's Compendium book, available on Amazon as well. And he's also a coach. And I think we started this discussion because I posted something about doing 10 bounds for distance and comparing myself with Will Clay, the world-class triple jumper. And I had a bunch of charts, and there was a lot of engagement going on Twitter. And I thought it was good to get Ryan on board and talk about the series of tests, when we do it, why we do it, and do they even correlate or translate. So Ryan, welcome. Thank you for making time for this today.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Okay, so let's, so we have a slide deck here that we're going to present. Ryan, can you see the screen?
Yes.
Yep. Okay. Okay, so let's start talking about testing. Ryan, on to you.
So when we look at, you know, testing, one of the things that I found really interesting, having a lot of discussions, especially in terms of how to train, what to do, and what to do in a situation that we're in right now, where we're kind of stuck at home, we're not allowed to get out and move about. And your post that you put on Twitter and Facebook about 10 bounds and the correlation to, you know, elite sports performance in the 100-meter dash really resonated with me, because it's something that I've thought a lot about in our situation when we're quarantined, is what's the right choice of activities to do and what are some things that maybe we can improve at home or test at home that will allow us to better prepare ourselves once we're allowed to get back onto our tracks, our clubhouses, things like that where we're supposed to train, and a way to keep ourselves motivated in spite of the fact that we might not be able to do traditional track and field or sports performance type workouts. And so we look at what we're testing, I kind of thought that, you know, what are we trying to test? What are we trying to improve? And on a recent call that I had with Tony Holler and Chris Corfus, that was with one of their series that they've been doing recently, you know, they were talking about bigger, faster, stronger. And Corfus' first question that he always asks people that he's going to work with or provide training plans for is which one of those should be first. Well, obviously, the bigger, faster, stronger folks, you know, the strength and conditioning guys, they tend to overemphasize weight room, increasing poundage, getting big for American football, things like that, versus probably what's more important, which is speed. So today, what we're going to do is we're going to kind of break down the things that you need to do to evaluate somebody who's supposed to be a fast twitch athlete in a series and battery of tests that we're going to work for. So we're going to be much more down on that speed corner of the triangle than the strength or endurance one today when we're talking about testing.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, so why should we test?
Yeah, so obviously, one reason for testing is to keep our athletes motivated in the absence of competitions. This is incredibly important in a traditional season with the long periods of time in between competitive phases, but even more important in a time period of how do we keep our athletes engaged? How do we keep them inspired? How do we keep them motivated when they're quarantined? So there's a lot of different philosophies on this. For me, what I like to do with my athletes, and we'll get into it more as we talk, you know, through this conversation, is I want to make sure that I'm developing a powerful, explosive athlete. And so on the right, I have an image of what's called a radar graph. And this is where they've layered over a bunch of different things that different sports find valuable, and their most elite athletes through those sports tend to check off the boxes at a rating system. You know, you could go from 1 to 10, 1 to 5, or whatever, and then move your way around depending on what you're trying to test. And so for me, again, this is a way of kind of showing and demonstrating strengths and weaknesses of the athlete. And I think it's an important process to do, is to kind of develop a battery of tests that help you figure out, okay, how agile is my athlete? What's their analytical aptitude? You know, basically how smart are they, or how creative they might be, you know, speed, power, strength, these type of things, durability. So there's all these types of tests that you want to develop. And then that chart and charting that information out will give you some sort of what I would like to call bumper rails, in terms of this is what it takes to be an elite athlete based off of these tests. Now, as a teacher, we hate to teach to the test, but the test does tell us something. And so it's always important to test your students and to test your athletes to figure out things that are going on. Tony Holler feels that, you know, his idea of record, rank, and publish is really important to keep his athletes motivated in terms of what's important, constantly building that competitive drive for a warrior type of athlete versus a thinker type of athlete. And so he uses a series of tests throughout the winter and throughout the summer to kind of keep his athletes motivated. And then he publishes those things out to the world. So, you know, it's the idea of not just kind of showing off, like, look how great my kids are, but it's actually more important to build a competitive fire amongst his sprint unit, and then also to hold them accountable. Tony Wells, he had a philosophy and a system, which I've discussed in other places at Altus and a couple other conversations with Robbie and the OPEX fitness folks. And his system, and I don't want to go into too much depth about it, but it entirely relied upon testing. And the three tests were standing long jump, power clean, or some kind of Olympic lift variation, and then flying short sprints. So it takes kind of the basic essence of what Tony does and adds the other two paradigms to it, which are this kind of idea of the jump, you know, part of it, which is more of the power part, the weight part, which is more of the strength part, and then, of course, keeping the speed. And then he would test those three paradigms through different phases throughout the season to try to figure out, okay, where is my athlete, you know, weak, and where is my athlete strong, and then what do I want to do to address it? And some things I find really interesting about that is one of the famous quotes from Tony Wells is, don't just test to test, test with purpose. The only reason why we're testing is so that we can learn something about our athletes and therefore improve them. So I find that to be really interesting. And one of the things that I find value in testing is kind of getting a deeper discovery of athletes. I'm a high school coach, so the first time I meet these athletes, they're probably going to be 13, 14, 15 years old. They have athletic experience, but most people don't come to track and field as that's their first sport. Typically, track and field, they come to because they're trying to get in shape for something else, or someone kind of leveraged them into competing or doing something, and they realize, oh, I have some innate talent. Well, that's fine and good, but we need to figure out what are those talents, where are your strengths and weaknesses, because just because you might be the best kid at your school and the fastest kid at your school in the 100 meters, that doesn't necessarily mean the 100 meters should be your event. So I feel like testing, giving us a chance to figure out what our strengths and weaknesses of our athletes are, is really, really important. More importantly, if you think about Anatoly Bondarchuk's system, where he's constantly changing things up when he finally sees and proves sports performance from a training stimulus, it's an idea of a check on coaching. So not only do we want to see what our athletes are doing and if they're doing well or what their strengths and weaknesses are, we also need to figure out, well, what are our strengths and weaknesses in our training plan? You know, ultimately, and we'll get into this as we talk, not all tests are created equal. Some tests are more important and have a higher value in terms of what we're really getting done in practice, how the athlete is adapting, and the chances of that athlete being really great. Another thing I use my testing for is maybe an ability to get the kid in a better event. So even though a kid might be, we had a young lady named Lizzie Desjois, and she was really fast as a freshman in the 100 meter dash. But the only thing that would tell you that she was really fast was the times on the stopwatch. everything else you would see about her, you're like, that athlete does not look like a sprinter. She doesn't move like a sprinter. She doesn't open up like a sprinter. She doesn't have a good block start, but she's pretty darn fast. Well, sure enough, wouldn't you know it, as we moved up in distance, she got better and better and better and ended up being, you know, in the top eight in the state of Missouri in a 5,000 meters and over a really gnarly cross country course. And she also was the best girl in the state of Missouri in the 800 meters. So this young lady was fast, but she was a really fast long sprinter, or AKA short distance runner, which I don't like to use that term very often.
Yeah.
Another thing, go ahead.
But the thing with testing is that I can give you two people that I coach. One, she was dominant in testing. She would destroy everyone in time trials, but come race day, she would just crumble. And conversely, I had another guy who just was terrible at testing. He just didn't perform well on test day, but come game day, he would just raise his game and the competition atmosphere would make him a better athlete. So, you know, it's like school. Just because you have a, you know, 2.8 on 4 GPA doesn't mean you're smart, as opposed to 4.0 GPA. And conversely, you know, there's book smart and there's street smart. So same thing about testing.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that that also speaks to the mental fortitude of those athletes and maybe the brain setup that they are, right? And so when we're talking about that, you have to think about, and we'll talk more about this, are they a thinker athlete or are they a warrior type? And there's actually data to show that there are DNA and some genes that might gear our athletes one way or another. And then from that, an inability to perform, even though they can do the tests really well, or conversely, you know, not doing well on the tests and perform like crazy, really speaks to some strategies that we should develop for our athletes in practice. Because like you said, they're not all the same, and what's smart and what's not, depending on how you grade something out, could totally be different depending on the field of play and the task at hand. When I'm about to make tests and put them together, it's really important to figure out what you're going to do ahead of time. And I know some of these things we have on here seem obvious, but location really matters. So if I am going to put together a database that I'm going to trust, that's going to inform me in the future about my athletes and help guide me not only in what event they do, but also what, you know, units of work that we do in practice or strategies periodization wise, etc. Location is important. And I know people go, well, what does that matter? Well, if you're constantly doing the tests at different facilities, different tracks, different directions, right? On a different part of the track. That's going to change your outcome, especially if you're doing tests that have small windows of error. So if you're doing a flying 10, the surface area, the length that you have of decelerization, the length that you have of acceleration, how hard that surface is, the direction of the wind, all of those things are going to matter, and it's important to keep that as consistent as possible. Who does the test? You know, one year is kind of silly, but we always do the standing long jump, which we'll talk about later. But that's one of our major tests. Well, one year, everybody improved by a foot. And I'm like, what the heck? I know we didn't do a whole lot different this year. Why is everyone testing better? And sometimes it's just experience with the test also makes you a better test taker as well. Doesn't mean you've actually improved your physical qualities. You've just hacked or nerfed the test, right? Well, sure enough, one of my coaches, who I love to death, he's a great teacher, but he didn't have a lot of experience in track. So he was growing into the coaching role of track and field through me. And this is the first day of practice in the first season. And he was measuring from the front of their toes. Instead of the back of their heels. There you go. Literally a foot, not just in inches, you know, on the imperial scale, but that's what's happening. So it's really important so that if the person who's giving the test is always making a slight error, that's okay, because that data can still inform you, even if that data might not help other people outside your program. Inside your program with your own data set, it can help.
No, definitely. So how about frequency? I know my program is 3 weeks hard, 1 week easy, and I use that easy week to do my testing. It works for me. it also works back in Canada and the US, because you had US Thanksgiving and Christmas. There were like 3 weeks, one, 3 weeks, one. So those weeks we don't do testing, but we always did testing September, October, and then come January. So how often do you do your testing? What's your frequency?
Well, depending on if I've got them over the winter, or we're just talking about the athletes coming out for the 3 month period of the season. Traditionally, my philosophy is no matter what, it's very similar to you. I go 3 weeks up and I unload the fourth week, and we usually drop 10 to 20% off of volume and load. And if we're out of season, we're going to do our test on that fourth week. If we're in season, we're going to try to match up their best event on that week as well. So we give them their legs back, we give them their arms back, to give it an opportunity to say, okay, we've done all this training. What are the effects? What's the outcome? Have we made improvements? Have we gone backwards? And so we basically do every 3 weeks. But a lot of times, I mean, because I'm a high school coach and we only have three and a half months of a track season, you know, we have to use our competitions as tests. But early on in the year, it's usually that third week. Now, for me in the regular season, I like to do some testing the very first day, because I like it, you know, I kind of think of it like being Christmas, and I get to open up all these presents and I want to know what I got. You know, I want to know how much the kids have improved from the previous year. And I want to know how good in particular modalities or abilities or skill sets my athletes are that are rookies or new in my program. Now, in addition to that three up and one down, we also tend to follow a theme. So I'll have a speed week, a power week, a strength or endurance week, and then the recovery week. We try to line up our workouts to fit that as well. And if we're in a regular season and we're going to use a race as a test to see where our fitness is at, we're also going to line that up with a meet that we think has a lot of value, and there will be a heightened level of competition to get to squeeze as much adrenaline out of that athlete as possible. So yeah, I think 4 weeks is good, especially when you're working with warrior type athletes that need frequent testing to keep themselves motivated and engaged in the process.
Sounds good. So let's talk about the, say, five different types of tests. We have running tests, weight room tests, jumping for height, jumping for distance, and maybe some throws like backward throws. So let's get into some of these tests now, Ryan.
Sure. So the chart you have here on the right is the chart that you'd posted up from your blog and your website. And I think it's really valuable, and it speaks to a lot of things. And most importantly, one of the things that I think we get in love with too much is the weight room. As strength and conditioning people and track coaches, we look at the weight room as being one of the easy ways to get improvements out of our athletes, and they can see they're improving because we're putting more weight on the bar. But here, you look at jump testing maybe being more valuable and maybe having a higher correlation to accurate predictors and performance. And the reason why this is because of the fact that when we're running really fast or we're sprinting really fast, we're jumping from one leg to another. It's a very plyometric activity. But for me, going back to the idea of what Corfis was talking about and Tony and others, speed is the number one thing. Speed is the most important thing. You can always find big people. Like, there are thousands upon thousands, maybe millions of ginormous men and women in the United States. But what separates them from being a big lumbering pokey type person and being someone who could make the NFL or, you know, women's rugby or something like that is the fact that they can move and that they're fast. So speed is always going to be the first test that we're going to lay out, because just in the order of operations, we want our athletes to be neurologically fresh, because via max velocity requires a really fresh nervous system and high percentages of effort of 93 to 95 at the lowest to actually create improved absolute speed. And so then from there, we're going to move to the jumps, which are more of the test for power. You know, so we're slowing the contacts down a little bit, but we're projecting the center of mass either up vertically or horizontally a lot, and we can learn quite a bit about that. Then I would probably do agility, but since I'm in a linear sport, I don't spend as much time worrying about agility tests. That's for the fall and the summer. the off seasons when athletes are doing other sports that require more, you know, side to side, up and down and backwards movement. But that doesn't mean that in training, I don't incorporate those things, because I do, because I want to keep my athletes healthy. And it's been proven that athletes that move through all planes of motion and movement tend to be the healthiest athletes. It's just not something that I spend a lot of time as a track coach in testing, but I did a lot when we were doing American football. You know, we do the pro shuttle and all that kind of stuff. Tests for strength, obviously, are fourth in my importance, because, again, there are plenty of very, very, very strong people, but very few bodybuilders are, you know, lining up for the Olympic final for the 100-meter dash. You know, they're fit people, they're strong, they're athletic, but they're not bodybuilders. So that's going to be fourth in terms of importance. Testing for injury prevention, that's something we do often, in season and out of season. I've got a really good trainer that runs our athletes through the functional movement screens and things like that, and provides us drills and activities so that we're being prescriptive, keep our athletes healthy. So if they've got something funky and imbalanced, a weakness in, you know, some sort of articulating joint, we're going to attack that specifically for those athletes. And we've done that. I have a family that they're immigrants from Nigeria, and each and every one of them has had serious problems with lower leg soreness, stress reactions, things like that. So we've radically changed some of the protocols that we do for those athletes so that they have a loose ankle, so they can move through the joints and they're more fluid. And then we also spend a little bit of time on the bike instead of on hard surface, as I would maybe with some of my other athletes. And through this testing and mobility screening, you can figure a lot of that stuff out. Testing for endurance, that's not per se like going out and running the mile, but we do that in a high school track team, because I have to do that because we have 19 events. But if I'm doing this for sprinters, that endurance is more based around race modeling, running 150s, 250s, longer intervals, or maybe doing what we're going to talk about here in the short term, talking about doing runs for time or covering distance for time, as opposed to just running a 350 or a 450. And then the last thing is, we need to know what makes our athletes tick. So I like to give them a couple questions that they have to answer to show me if they're left or right brained, to show me how much they value family and how honest they are. You know, if an athlete tells you they're lazy, they're lazy. And if they're telling you they're lazy, they're being honest too, which is a really interesting thing. They're not just telling you the answer you want to hear. They're telling you the answer they think you need to hear. And I find a lot of value in that, even though that's considered a negative stereotype in terms of a personality trait. It's something I find important because it informs me on the athlete before I start coaching them.
That's pretty good. That's quite exhaustive. Series of tests. I never considered the last few, but let's go into some specifics on the next slides. Okay, let's start with this slide here, hamstring versus quad centric. What kind of tests do you do, and types of tests do you do to test this?
So Jonas, who is, he was mentored by Dan Pass, says if it was up to him, he'd want all his athletes to be pullers, you know, or nervous driven sprinters, and more simply put, hamstring centric sprinters. But when you get these athletes, they've learned to run and be fast through different modes of movement. And a hamstring centric and a quad centric sprinter, they're going to inform you on the things that you probably need to do in training to maximize their strengths. So before we can do that, obviously you can look at both Craig Pickering and Asafa Powell, and you could probably figure out who's the quad centric sprinter and who's the hamstring centric sprinter just by body position, toe off, bend at the knee, and how, you know, they're built. I mean, Asafa Powell is a well-built guy, and he lifted a lot of weights and all that kind of stuff before he hurt his pectoral muscle benching a ton. But Craig Pickering is a monster. You know, he ended up being a pretty successful bobsledder after his career in sprinting. You know, Craig is a quadricentric sprinter, really good at the 60 meter dash, really good at the 100, rarely runs the 200. You know, even though I kind of back about 7 or 8 years ago, I was pushing on him to run the 2 because I felt like it probably would help his 100. But he's a quad centric sprinter, and he looks the part. Not just because he looks the part of a rugby player, you know, or a American football player, that doesn't always mean that a guy built like that's going to be a quad centric sprinter. But they tend to be. And then the more lean, long, bouncy guys tend to be hamstring centric. Now, beyond that, other ways that you can test, to see if they like to throw a medicine ball forward, you know, so they hop forward and throw forward, and do they tend to trend outward, you know, beyond their peers in that, or do they like to throw the medicine ball overhead and back with a jump, and they tend to trend as an outlier that way. If they tend to trend as an outlier with the forward toss, they're probably quad centric. If they tend to trend, you know, as an outlier with the overhead back, they're probably hamstring centric because that's where they're powerful and explosive and they feel strong. If they like to deadlift, they're probably a hamstring centric sprinter. If they like to squat, they're probably a quad. If they tend to double arm, which we'll talk about here, versus single arm bound, if they double arm bound to a triple jump movement, they tend to be more of a quad centric sprinter. If they single arm, they tend to be more hamstring because they're bouncy and they're going through that natural fluid movement. So there's all these types of things that you can do to test them. Now, once you figure that out, then there's going to be consequences to what type of sprinter they are. So if they're quad centric, they're going to do much better with bilateral lifts and jumps. If they're hamstring centric, they're going to be doing much better with unilateral jumps, single leg, weight room action, proprioceptive types of things. If they're a quad centric, you tend to have to cue them on the ground, what they're doing in the ground or when they're touching something. If they're a hamstring centric sprinter, you spend more time cueing them of what they should be feeling internally as opposed to what they're feeling externally through the pressure of their feet. And so there's all sorts of things that can be done to kind of benefit these athletes, but you've got to figure out what their strengths and weaknesses are and where they kind of lean. Now, one of the things, because kind of going with what Jonas said, with preferring hamstring-centric sprinters, I like to work on their weaknesses in the off season, because you can take some risks, but in the in season, I would much rather work on their strengths, because you don't want to wreck, you know, the model. If it ain't broke, don't fix it kind of idea. But over the off season, you can play with some of their weaknesses to try to attack those things and mess with those things when they're not under the pressure of pushing and pulling in competition.
Yeah, good point. I remember when I was submaster, so 35 years old, and I was training under Kevin Tyler in Vancouver. And in the first week of practice, he saw me running. He says, "Jimson, you're very quad centric." And by then I'm 35 years old. I've been running for 9 years. It's hard to teach an old dog new tricks, but then, you know, we did some changes with some mock drills and you know, heel flicks, butt kicks, and try to work on that backside mechanics a bit more just to get that hamstring development working. And it worked out actually. So, okay, that's good. Let's move on to some speed tests. I think people want to hear speed tests. So,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, let's talk about the traditional, you know, 30 meter test and block start, and then a 30 meter fly time. Talk about some of your experiences and what you get out of it.
Sure. So this is another way to kind of figure out a quad versus hamstring centric athlete as well. So it kind of blends into this. You know, if they're really an outlier as an accelerator, they could be a quad centric. If they're really an outlier as a flying sprinter, you know, they're way over the top, but they maybe their acceleration isn't as good. That probably informs you on what type of athlete they are. And just thinking about some of the pictures that you actually shared, Jimson, from back in the day when you were running as a younger guy, I could have probably told you that you were quad-centric, because I'm thinking of a particular picture where I feel like you had a real deep knee bend at contact and the leg even looked twisted. Do you know what I mean? Like you're really, and I'm sure you're running indoors and you're on the turn, but it was interesting because you could see that amortization and that kind of really going down and then really forcing that foot back off the ground. So that's a nice catch from Kevin Tyler back in the day with you. So that's really, really interesting. Now, these two tests, in my opinion, are by far the cream of the crop. If you can't do anything else, these two tests will inform more about your athlete's ability set or potential, because pretty much everything we do in track and field requires fast twitch athletes and a high rate of speed. But even in most sports that aren't golf, you know, or things like that, you need to be explosive, you need to be fast. And even when people are like, well, you know, on a basketball court, you never reach full speed. Well, no, you don't. But you've talked a lot about speed reserve and the importance of it. And so even if you're not going at full speed on a basketball court, your 80% is going to be at a much higher velocity than other people's 80%. And that's going to improve your overall ability because you have the speed reserve where you can run up and down the basketball court without giving much effort and never being behind and never having to worry about trying to make a real bad play to cut off an athlete trying to head to the baseline for a basketball, you know, shot. And so this test, even though you think this might be for track, these are great for everyone. For me specifically, out of the two, the most important between the two is the flying test. In my school's history, and I've got a database now of over a decade of these tests with my athletes done in a very similar way in pretty much the exact same location and done by me. So I'm the only person who have done these tests for almost two decades, but I've got data on 10 years. And what I've found is on the flying 30, 18 of the top 20 scores that I have in the flying 30, all of those young ladies, except for the two, were state qualifiers or all state track and field athletes in Missouri. And I know a lot of people who are international listeners have no idea about Missouri track and field, but we're really good. We are really good, especially for our size. You know, we have the world record holder under 18 just up the road from me and Justin Robinson. He's coached by my mentor and he's a critical mass trained athlete. And this flying 30 is so critically important. And then what's interesting is even if their scores aren't that good, but they're a distance runner, guess what? The fastest kids that are distance runners in the flying 30 are also the best distance runners. So even though they might not be in the top 40 amongst my athletes all time in the flying 30, amongst themselves in their specific event group, lo and behold, they tend to be the best, you know, and we have the state record in Missouri for the 4x8. And I've had many look at our program with the best athletes in state history. I have the most representation of all the events I've got is in the 800 statewide. And so even with that flying 30 for them, it becomes important because it gives you an idea of their potential and their ability. The really cool thing about these tests is they're not physically or energy system exhaustive. They are neurologically exhaustive, but you can do these with some frequency. And sometimes if you take the Tony Holler feed the cats model, this is all you have to do in some practices. And you're going to get a lot out of it as long as you raise the adrenaline up to get the 93 to 95% effort that you want. And then what I typically do is I'll take the standing 30, the flying 30, make that a 60. And then that really helps, especially when you're in the beginning of the season or in a training plan where you haven't done a lot of speed work. That will inform you about their ability set, not only to the 60, but probably the 100 meter dash as well, without having them to run the 100 meter dash or something longer to figure those speeds out.
Yeah, no, exactly. It all comes down to speed. And I can't stress that more than, you know, promoting speed in all sports, even marathon runners. It all comes down to how fast your 100 is, how fast your 30 is, really. So it's a good point. Let's move on. I like this, actually. Let's go to power. Power is one of my favorite ones, which was the one I was talking about, my 10 bounds for distance from a standing start. There's also another one we do, which is only 5 bounds from a running start. Tell me some of your tests and success rates and any kind of correlations that you've seen with these tests.
Well, for sure, the standing long jump does a great job in testing block clearance. So the people who have the best standing long jump tend to be the best clears from the blocks. That also tend to be our best long jumpers and triple jumpers. So even though, you know, a dirty secret behind the curtain in my program is we've not been very good in the high jump or the pole vault, and there's some reasons for that, but we've been very, very good in the horizontal jumps. We had a young lady break our school record last year. She went 18.6, 18 feet 6 inches, which is a pretty nice jump for a high schooler, and she also happened to be one of our best 400-meter runners in school history, and she was a really good triple jumper too. And sure enough, when she first came out in our program, she tested high on the standing and we have actually a standing 5 bounds because a lot of these kids just can't do 10 they're not in shape enough to really do that and maintain it. They kind of break down. So we shortened that up and went to five from a standing. But in the standing long jump and the five repeat bounce from a standing, she was off the charts, even though her standing 30 and flying 30 weren't that great. Well, she was a gymnast, and she had been used to running a certain way to run to the vault, right, in gymnastics. And once we kind of tweaked that stuff over time, she kept getting faster and faster and faster. But if you would have looked at her body build and the way that she was put together, you would have thought this kid is a distance runner. She was a strength bean, you know, and looked and acted like a traditional distance runner. And so if it wasn't for these tests to test her power and the knowledge that we knew that she was a gymnast, she might have never done her best event and ended up being the school record holder. And that she broke a record for us that had been there since 1981. So, I mean, there were a lot of other good jumpers in between that time, but she was by far the best. Now, why is this important? Well, if you look down here on the chart, which is from Anatoly Bondarchuk's transfer of training, it shows correlations to alternative training means besides running and how much they correlate to improve sports performance. Now, what's really crazy about this is a power clean and snatch for an elite woman can possibly negatively impact or negatively correlate. So if you're spending time doing a power clean or a snatch as a runner who's a female sprinter under 23 seconds, you're probably wasting your time. But then if you drag down, you'll notice, oh, well, what does correlate? Well, these repeat bounds sure do correlate. They're the highest almost by double. So that should inform your training as well as to what you should be doing. And even if an athlete doesn't do well on those first two tests that we talked about, but they do well on this, that informs you that they have the ability, they just haven't learned how to use it as a, you know, max velocity type setup or an acceleration setup. So you're now informed, okay, those are the things that I can attack as a weakness. And then in the regular season, I can build on this strength of this bounding power ability that this athlete has. And eventually over time, we'll build this complete athlete who will be dangerous. And sure enough, this young lady who graduated in 2019, she ended up also setting our varsity record in total points scored throughout her career. So she became really good at the 100, really good at the 200, really good at the 400, the long, the triple, the high jump. She probably could have been a great hurdler if I wanted to take that risk, but the injuries just didn't make sense for how good she was at other things, you know? And so we just kept moving down the line of the jumps and the long sprints, and it worked out really, really, really well. And again,
But I think the biggest question on Twitter was, does it correlate to sprinting? Like Nick Newman wrote back right away saying he had a Finnish triple jumper, I guess in college at Berkeley, and his five bounds was more than my 10 bounds, and he can't even, you know, doesn't break 11 seconds in 100 meters. So he's off the charts, but he's a triple jumper. So is there any correlation between doing the bounds, let's say, you know, the bounding events and sprinting? That's the big question. And if you look at a force velocity curve, you know, elastic power is somewhere, you know, in the middle. How does it correlate? And if there is a correlation?
Well, I think that, you know, if you went back to that chart and you look at this chart, there is a correlation. There's a correlation to improve sports performance. I think it's interesting. You got to ask the question is, why is that Finnish jumper so darn good at that one thing? I bet you that there was an early intervention training-wise that they basically said, okay, long-term development model, instead of giving this kid a variety of experiences as an athlete as they grow, we're going to only focus on this. And so what that should tell you is, instead of just accepting it, it's one of those things where you're like, this is great. This is strong. This shows that they should be super elite in this area as well, but they're not. Well, in the off season, let's really address that problem and move that needle down. Maybe he'll never be a 10-2 guy because that's just not in his ability. He's just very elastic. He's, you know, he's very bouncy. He might have a really low body weight to, you know, to body weight to power ratio and all that kind of stuff. But if you got the kid down to a 10-5, how much better of a jumper would he be? And Tony Wells would tell you, because he's not testing out well over here, but he's testing out extremely as an outlier over here, you have a glaring problem that you must address to make this athlete better. I mean, if you look at Mondo, the pole vault kiddo from LSU, the guy, when he was in high school, he was able to run as a high schooler, I think it was his junior season, a 10.60 FAT 100-meter dash. It's a pretty fast dude. You know, Anatoly Bondarchuk, or not Anatoly Bondarchuk, sorry, Sergei Bubka, getting my Russians and Ukrainians mixed up. Sergei Bubka was a low 10-meter or 10-second 100-meter dash guy as well, if you believe those numbers. So it requires a certain window of ability. And if the other skill sets aren't within that window, those are opportunities to attack, to dramatically improve the athlete. And Tony Wells would have demanded it. I mean, that's why he called it adapt or die. He's like, you are going to adapt to this weakness and we're going to make this better. If we don't, then, you know, we're going to just keep grinding until I see a training stimulus out of it. Same thing with Anatoly Bondarchuk. You know, he wouldn't change the stimulus until he saw a change. And then he would go and move to a new stimulus to try to continue to chase that better and better athlete. It's really interesting. So, yeah, I think you ask a good question. And, you know, obviously Nick Newman is much smarter than me about the jokes. But I think that there's an opportunity there. And it would be interesting to see the history and the training logs of that Finnish athlete when they were younger.